Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past few years, today's guest, documentary filmmaker and educator Andre Robert Lee, has led civil rights tours throughout the South for The Nation magazine. The group visits the Legacy Museum and National Civil Rights Memorial to Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, the nation's first memorial commemorating the victims of lynching in the United States. They tour the Medgar Evers Home Museum, where he was murdered in 1963, and they travel to Birmingham and visit the 16th Street Baptist Church, where a bomb killed four young African-American girls as they prepare to sing in their choir on September 15th, 1963. The new documentary, The Road to Justice, follows two groups on recent tours, a group of mostly black middle school students from Chicago and a group of mostly white older Americans who lived through the civil rights era. The film asks, how can we heal as a nation without honestly confronting our history? Here is the trailer for the documentary, The Road to Justice.
I was a big mouth as a kid. I questioned everything. If we were walking on the same sidewalk, I would have looked the white man in the eye. Down south, my mouth could have probably got me in trouble.
I worry about the direction that we're heading in. This problem that we have that is America. We have to be honest about our history.
The land of the free and the home of the brave, because our lives be threatened daily.
You can't skip these difficult conversations and get to reconciliation. It's impossible.
What do you say?
This is it. This is ground zero of the civil rights movement.
This isn't just black history. It's American history.
That is a trailer for the documentary, The Road to Justice. You can host a screening of the film along with an optional workshop led by the filmmakers. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we are so happy to be joined by Andre Robert Lee, a filmmaker, activist, and teacher. He's executive director of the documentary, The Road to Justice. He also directed and produced The Prep School Negro, a film that revisits the high personal cost his elite education caused as he visits with current day black prep school students to see what's changed since he attended. His latest film, Virtually Free, is about incarcerated youth in Richmond, Virginia. As I said in the intro, he's led a civil rights tour of four southern states for The Nation magazine since 2018, and he teaches filmmaking at the Germantown Friends School in Philadelphia. Hi, Andre. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for having me. This is fantastic.
Well, I love the film, and I really want to see The Prep School Negro. If you don't mind, I'd love to start by talking about you a little bit, because the trailer was just so interesting, and then learning a little bit more about you. As we learn in this film, you and your sister grew up in the ghettos of Philadelphia. Your mom struggled to support you by putting strings in your waistbands of track pants and swimsuits in a local factory. And when you were 14, you got a full scholarship to attend one of the most prestigious prep schools in the country. So I bet we could spend a whole hour on this, but can you just give us a little thumbnail sketch of your childhood and kind of how you got to this place?
Yeah, you know, that is such an interesting story. Thank you for alluding to that and mentioning it. It's funny, right before this, I sent a text to my sister saying, I'm going to be on the radio, tune in. You know, so I hope you're listening, Robin. I think, you know, I was one of those kids in North Philadelphia, a pretty rough section of Philadelphia that, you know, I was an egghead. I always had my heads in books. I loved to read. My mother was a reader, so I think I learned that from her. It was just this really strained intellectual kid living in North Philadelphia. And I got a scholarship. And the way I got the scholarship, I think, really tells a story. My mother saw a therapist secretly. We didn't know about this until she passed away. She saw a therapist for years. And I met him after, I saw him again after doing the film. And I asked him, I said, you know, what am I about to talk about in our sessions? I said, I can't tell you everything. But one thing I can say is, she said, my boy needs something else. My boy needs something. And she couldn't say Germantown Friends School or a scholarship, but she knew that I needed something else. And so the two of them worked together and got me into Germantown Friends School. And I went there and my eyes were just opened wide to a world that was a good place for me to go, challenging and also a good place to go. As you mentioned, my mother worked in a factory. And one of the facts, the man who owned the factory, his son was in my class. And so first day of school, I'm looking over thinking like, wow, our tuition is more than your father pays my mother. Mm. You know, I'm 14, 15 trying to process all of that. And very, like, very excited about the community. And I made the film because I slipped into a world of shame. I felt very ashamed of where I came from, my background, and was comparing myself way too much to the folks in my class without real, true barometers. Just on some superficial levels. And so it really was an incredible, it was the right place for me. I often joke and say, you know, my sister, who's very different from me and the same, exactly the same at the same time, she's very different when it comes to academics and the like. And I like to joke and say, the school was good for me, but not good for her. I think she would have burnt the school to the ground, you know, but I went in there and thrived in lots of ways. So yeah, the film was all about trying to tell that story of what it was like to move into that world of an extreme, to be an extreme other in an environment, and the benefits and the challenges and all the in between.
And I guess what went through my mind is, did you get support at that school? And then what has really changed based on the young Black people that you interviewed who have also gone to these kinds of prep schools?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you mentioned in the introduction that I'm teaching there now. I was living in New York City in the schools in Philadelphia, and the school was like, we want you to teach film here. And I said, I live in New York City, you know, and they kept pushing and pulling and making it work. And I said yes, because I wanted to work with the children and I wanted to be what I needed in high school. Mm. So what I'm able to do now is to be a part of the community, and I'm teaching filmmaking, but I'm also involved in all kinds of areas. I'm jumping ahead. It hasn't been announced yet. I don't know if it will be announced, but I'll be actually working with the school on another level to help think about professional development in the coming fall. I've gotten really involved in the school because I care about it. And the experience of inviting lower income students into private high schools is a really challenging one. And when the race issue comes up, the financial issue comes up, and we have to find ways to support the students, because it's great to welcome them into the community. But when you bring someone that functions, looks, acts, eats, dances, everything differently from the majority of other people, the community has to change and has to adjust to make it fit. This past year, we graduated a number of students who were really dynamic and who really have put a good stamp on the school and have helped shape the school, helped reshape the school, because they've talked about what they wanted and needed. And it takes, you know, openness on both sides to say, we want to learn and grow and love and support you. And we have to make some sacrifices and some changes. And that's hard. The Germantown Friends School is over 100, it just celebrated its 175th year. You know, it's an old school and it has lots of ways that have been ingrained into it. And we're welcoming in this new community of people. And what does it mean to shift and to adjust? And sometimes your best intentions, your good intentions, miss the mark. And how do we all learn and grow together is a question that I'd like to ask when it comes to it. So the students, that's a very long answer to say that as we see in our society, we have to shift and change and readjust, because some of our ways that have been built with the best intentions in mind don't fit for everybody. And how do we get closer towards that moment of equity and justice and acceptance where folks can feel value, love, supported, and welcomed into environments?
When you were at that school, did you talk about some of the things that you now teach and discuss on your civil rights tours of the southern states?
Hmm. You know, I dabbled in it, and I couldn't say systemic racism. I couldn't say economic inequality. I could say, this doesn't feel right. It doesn't. Why does your family have this and my family have that? Why doesn't my family have the same thing your family has? That's how I talked about it, you know. And I have moments of like, I don't feel full or whole, or my whole self isn't welcomed here in numerous ways. So I didn't talk about it at the level I talk about it now. it really was in ninth grade when I figured out what my career should be. You know, I said, I want to work on access. Because I got into the school and I saw how great the world was. And I saw all the academic, you know, we had the luxury of education. This is my favorite story I love telling. When I got to Germantown Friends School, I had read everything by Judy Blume, everything she ever written, you know, because I was an avid reader. And we had summer reading the summer before I started my ninth grade. And I was like, what's summer reading? That's weird. And the books were Toni Morrison's Sula, Mary Renault's The King Must Die, and Pearl S. Buck's The Good Earth. And I got those books in my hand. And I was like, whoa, this is incredible. And I felt my life shifting and my intellectual self being turned on and sparked and grown, as every kid does in high school, I imagine. And I got in there and I saw the way we looked at things and the privileges we had and the access we had and the freedom I had to think and to express my ideas. And I began thinking, like, why doesn't every child in America have this education? Why doesn't my family know about and have access to various parts of society and believe that they can participate at the same level as the folks in this school? Because my family wasn't thinking that way. We were lower income. We knew our place. And I was being told and challenged to think, your place is anything you want it to be. And that was a new concept for me. And I thought, I want the world to know this. I want people to know they have access and they can achieve and they can thrive and they should do their best no matter what. You know, growing up in North Philadelphia, which is a very rough part of the city at that time, a beautiful, wonderful part of the city, but also, you know, economic exclusion, support from the government, all those pieces that fall into place structured what North Philly was. And I went into the school and saw a whole different world and thought, why doesn't everyone have this kind of world? And I became very committed to trying to communicate to as many people as possible that they can have this access and achieve at this level.
It's such a beautiful story, and it just speaks to the power of and the importance of education. And I just, when you were talking, I was thinking about the importance of making sure that everyone has access to a good school and then college if they choose to do it. And we're still at this place where that is just not possible for so many people.
Yeah, that is, yes, that is the truth. And, you know, what's exciting about it and gives me hope. I just did a screening in Des Moines, Iowa, and someone said, you know, looking at this history and look at all the things you talk about, how do you keep hope? And I looked over at this little boy that was in the room and I was like, right over there, there's my hope. That kid right there, his mother brought him to this screening tonight. He's here. He may have been 8 or 9. He probably didn't get the whole movie, but we're planting seeds in his mind. And we're saying, demand justice, young man, you know, fight for and push for justice. We all deserve it. And what keeps me hopeful and what I do believe is I do believe we can achieve. I'm a dreamer. You know, I believe, I have faith, and I watch young people who I love because they don't take anything, which is great. They drive me nuts and push back on things that I want to try and do. And I accept it at every turn. I love the push and demand that we're seeing in our society right now to get us closer to what the world could be. Mm-hmm. You know, there's enough for everybody, you know, and I when I zero in and take it back to me, and this is just Andre, and I believe in communicating this. When I made the Prep School Negro story, I was not telling the story of every single Black child in private schools. I wasn't telling the story of every single Black lower income child in private schools. I was telling my story. Over the years, I've had people connect and feel it in ways that I never imagined. I just once again, Des Moines, I just made a connection with a woman who, you know, is overseeing their acquisitions of art at this major company. And I just mentioned Prep School Negro. She goes, whoa, I really feel connected to that. She's a white woman who went to a private school and a scholarship, and she was a lower income student herself and talked about that feeling of extreme other. And she and I have begun this dialogue that I never expected, you know? Mm-hmm. So I go back to what I went into, like, I didn't think I belonged. I didn't think I deserved. All these things were in my mind, and I had to overcome them. I still work to overcome them. Thank you to my therapist, if you're out there listening. But I still work to overcome them on a daily basis. And I've accepted that as a mission to try and bring people into that space of acceptance and inclusion and welcome.
Andre Robert Lee is a filmmaker, activist, and teacher, and we've got links to all of his films. The Prep School Negro revisits the high personal cost his elite education caused as he visits with current-day prep school students to see what's changed since he attended. He is also executive director of The Road to Justice. And in that film, we follow two groups of people, one group mostly Black middle school students from Chicago and a group of mostly white older Americans who are on a tour of the civil rights tour of Southern states. And Andre leads this tour for The Nation magazine. How did you connect with The Nation to lead these incredible tours?
Yeah, you know, and I love that question. Kai Wright, who is a fantastic writer and radio personality here in New York City on WNYC. Kai was working at the magazine for a while as the director of features and the like. And the magazine does trips. It has a really robust travel experience. And they do a lot of international trips. And they decide, you know what, we need to do something domestic. And they asked Kai about leading the civil rights trip as a thought leader. And Kai was like, I know nothing about this. You know, I can't lead trips. But I have a friend who has been leading them. So it actually all started with this little school in Durham, North Carolina called Carolina Friends School. And they lead civil rights trips themselves. And the year they started doing them, they needed a male chaperone. And I had shown Prep School Negro at the school, loved the school. Had great connections there. My friend Tony Williamson had started the tour a year or two before I came. And they said, we need a male chaperone. Are you interested? And I said, sure. What does that mean? You know? And so I get on there and I drive a little. It's like the shorter school bus. We drive from Durham, Carolina to Birmingham, Alabama. And we are looking for the tour. We have it on paper, but we're there looking for restaurants, looking for the spots. It's all like trying to figure it out. Because, like I said, my friend Tony set it up and then handed it off to us, and it was us to redevelop. So I spent a good 7-8 years working with them. So when The Nation came and said, we want to do this tour, I was like, great. I've been to most of these spots. I know some good stuff. And then Janet from Distant Horizon, she's just a whiz. And like, if you want to take a tour with Janet, because she's fantastic. And what we do in our tours is we actually sit down with locals. Like, I was the thought leader and I was guiding people through. So once again, started with middle school students. The Nation called me after a contact through my friend Kai. And I said, sure, I'll do this. Went on the trip and just had a blast and learned so much on these trips. And it expanded, became something very powerful and magical.
It's really amazing. It's so comprehensive. What strikes you about the people who join these tours? Because these tours are, we should say, are not cheap. They're pretty expensive.
Yeah. I think about that. They're a fundraiser for the magazine.
Right.
You know, the Nation magazine is the oldest magazine in the country. Started after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated by abolitionists to really communicate and continue on the story. And you know, print is a tough world. And so they do these trips as fundraisers. So the price point is high. And the kind of people that come, they're fantastic. Yeah. I remember the first tour, I was so nervous because there's a woman on the tour who was Adam Clayton Powell's clerk. And I thought, what can I teach you about civil rights? You know, at all. Like, here's the mic. Go tell us what you know. But everyone there was there to learn. And one thing I took from a tour in terms of thinking about the participants, there was a gentleman who was a writer for the New York Times. And, you know, very astute, very intellectual, great, great guy. And he said at the end of the tour, he said, you know, I came on this tour knowing civil rights. I leave this tour feeling civil rights. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's powerful. That's mm-hmm. what we want. You know, we can read about this stuff all day long, but until you are in Selma, Alabama, talking to one of my favorite people in the world, Miss Annie Pearl. Miss Annie Pearl was a child during the Bloody Sunday when the march from Selma to Montgomery. She was there as a little girl the first day and remembers, you know, all the terror, and has committed her entire life to fighting for justice. And she's 80 something now, and she every single election, she's at the foot of the bridge with a sign that says "Vote or Die." You know, and she's just wonderful. When our travelers go and sit with her, that takes you away from the textbook, the article, the documentary. This is, you're in it. You're talking to somebody that walked
this life and lived it. And it's just, it's transformative in numerous ways.
I mean, that must be so amazing because these places have so much history. But as you say, to meet the people who lived it and had to endure the beatings, the racism, I mean, that must be incredible, emotional. It brings out so much.
Yeah, it truly does. I'm thinking of Birmingham. In Birmingham, you know, in the film, we have a brother and sister who hadn't been back to Birmingham much in their lives. They turned 18 and kind of left. They were there during the Children's March, during the protests. Like, they were there for the Fuller girls were murdered. They were there. And they were a white family that was separate. Their mother said, "We're not getting involved in that. We know it's wrong, but we're not getting involved in that." She says that. And a magic thing happened on the trip. Our bus driver told me and pulled me aside and said, "I want you to know that I was actually one of the kids at the Birmingham March. I got sprayed by hoses." And I looked at him and I was like, "Whoa, can you say more about that?" And I tried to get him to talk to the travelers and he wouldn't do it. Mm. He said, "Do you mind, sir, if I just sit back and watch?" He would talk to me one-on-one because he was listening to the tour. You know, it's a moment of like, you never know who's around you. He was listening to the tour and checking in, and like, he would show up at all the events. And I asked him to talk to the travelers and said, "I can't, I just can't do it," which I get. I mean, we've all seen those images of children being sprayed with hoses that has the power to rip the bark off a tree. You know, that's what was happening. So we did meet during the trip. We visited in the 16 Feet Baptist Church with Carolyn McKinstry, and she was at the Church of the Dead bombing. She was in her pastor's office. The phone rang, and the guy said, "You got 4 minutes." And she went, "What?" and hung the phone up and walked out into the sanctuary, and the bomb went off and she was thrown a couple of feet. Mm. You know, we sit with her in the actual sanctuary in the church. She tells that story. And I remember thinking, the bus driver was sitting in the back of the room listening to the story, and there's Carolyn up front. And I have my little secret, knowing that he knows this stuff and he knows Carolyn, but he didn't want to talk about it. But he did have other conversations with the travelers. So that reflects what this trip is about. You know, our bus driver is the history, you know, and giving me little notes. He's like, "Hey, tell your travelers this." And I'm like, "Will you tell him?" He's like, no, you tell him." It was kind of adorable. And also at the same time, like, thinking about what that meant for a grown man to still have that kind of trauma in his life, and showing up the way that he could.
Right. And then hearing stories from the white people on the trip. In the film, we meet one woman who said her grandparents were slave owners.
Yeah.
And she really wanted to come on this tour.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's this tour is a deep exploration of self. You really have to take a hard, long look at who you are, how you show up in the world, and how you participate. I was lucky, like the Nation magazine and the Distant Horizon group, they set it up, the trip, and then they allowed me to come in and help reshape it. Mm-hmm. And after each trip, we reshaped it and we did do things and turn things around, because something we do nearly every day during the trip is I have a debrief where I sit with everybody and say, "Okay, we just visited the site where MLK was shot. How are you feeling? What's happening for you? What are you processing?" That's folded all throughout the trip. And it ranges from individual conversations to actually large group meetings. And something I say to folks at the beginning of the trip is that we need to acknowledge that this trip is very different for a person of color. You know, a white person will have one experience, a person of color will have another experience. And we need to find a way to come together and talk about those shared experiences, celebrate our differences, and learn and grow together.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Andre Robert Lee is a filmmaker, activist, and teacher. He leads civil rights tours of 4 southern states for The Nation magazine. The new documentary, The Road to Justice, follows 2 groups on recent tours, a group of mostly black middle school students from Chicago and a group of mostly white older Americans who lived through the civil rights era. And the film asks, how can we heal as a nation without honestly confronting our history? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. to Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're joined by Andre Robert Lee, an activist teacher and filmmaker. You can find more information about his films at yourcallradio.org. The Prep School Negro, Virtually Free, is about incarcerated youth in Richmond, Virginia. And his latest is The Road to Justice. Andre takes people on civil rights tours of southern states for The Nation magazine, and The Road to Justice follows two groups on recent tours. One group is mostly white. They're older Americans who lived through the civil rights era. And I want to play a clip from the film. In this clip, you will hear from two of the black men on the trip, Kermit and Bill. You will also hear from Catherine. Here is a clip from the documentary, The Road to Justice.
Then I recognized that there are only three black people in the group.
Would you mind starting here? Do you like to share with us?
Oh, I'm Catherine Collins. My brother Doug has already confessed that we grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, where segregation was the water we swam in. I've been trying to come to terms with what was it about me that couldn't realize what was going on around me.
If we believe that systemic racism is a thing, economic distribution was unfair in American society, this is why the group looks the way it looks. This may be a little hard to digest, but if you look back at when the Federal Housing Act was passed, the majority of that money went to white people. It's part of the reason why many of you can afford to be here now.
I've oftentimes found myself in a space where I'm the only black person. Immediately, the wheel starts spinning. Okay, take it, you breathe. And then what's going to happen here? Which of me should I be? Then you start gauging the room and thinking, okay, what kind of white people are here? Okay, so I can be this.
Mr. Evers was born in Decatur, Mississippi.
That's tiring. That's like taking on someone else's feelings along with your own. It's like doing double duty.
But I did my protesting mostly in Brooklyn. Whatever issue came up, I was out there shouting and screaming and carrying on. This trip provides me an opportunity to refresh my memory and to talk to my grandkids, all 17 of them, about what we've encountered and how far we still have to go.
My grandmother was a slave. And I've talked to some of you today about other aspects of my family. I'm trying to deal with my anger. And I believe good folks like you will help me with that.
That is a clip from the documentary, The Road to Justice. And that was the group of mostly older white Americans who lived through the civil rights era. We heard from two black men on the trip, Kermit and Bill. And we're joined by Andre Robert Lee, who's executive director of The Road to Justice. And he leads those civil rights tours for The Nation magazine. Andre, it was just so interesting to hear Bill and Kermit, especially Kermit, say that he's often the only black man in the room. Is that a common experience for you, that there are very few black people on these trips?
Yes. Yes. The price point alone. You know, listening to that clip just now, I remember the day I decided to start saying in my introduction that look around a room and there's a reason why the room looks the way it does. Part of my work, what I have been pushing for lately, is to really say that we have to stop saying that we don't know why we don't study this. We don't know why this happened. We need to understand and look at our American history, take it apart, deconstruct it, and rebuild, and know why it looks the way it does. So yes, on our trips, we've had majority white people, because if we look at, I mean, you can pull apart and look at economic advantages, disadvantages, who was able to participate, who was able to build wealth in America. And a large number of white people have wealth in America now. And at that age of folks who travel with us, typically I think above 60, 65 and up, they were able to, they have pensions now connected to building wealth over time, you know, so they can come on this trip. And, you know, it's also the Nation Magazine readers. It's a very specific group. I think it's important to say that. Right. But yeah, it looks the way it looks because of financial ability in America. America has a history of denying people of color access to wealth. We're seeing that we look at the wealth gap right now. It is still very present in our society. So yes, in those spaces, in our trips, we have majority white. I think it is two things, the Nation Magazine readership and then also financial ability in America.
And do you hear many people share the experience of Kermit when he said that he's often the only black man in the room? I mean, what really strikes you about the experience that older black people have on these trips?
Yeah, it's great. We typically average one or two per trip of people of color, period. You know, the experience of black people, it's heavy because this is our history, you know, and we think about how, when we go home, how it impacts us directly, how it impacted our ancestors. You know, I remember the first time going to Jackson, Mississippi and seeing so many streets with the last name Lee, or this Lee Street, Lee, everything. I was like, wow, you know, and I joke like, oh, Robert Lee probably owned my family. That's how I got my last name. Ha ha ha. You know, and it could be true because I was just the other day talking to someone and saying, I never heard my grandmother say parent. I never heard her talk about parents. Hmm. She was a woman who migrated from the South, you know, was one generation away from slavery. And we live in the wake of the disruption of our American society from slavery. And then we go forward to Jim Crow, which is the area that we study on the trip, and take apart and deconstruct and look at these realities that structured our society that impacted many, many, many people. And here we are living in the face of it. And this is why in some environments we find ourselves being a handful of black people. I remember on one trip, we were in Birmingham, Alabama. We were in Montgomery, Alabama. And there was this group of black women who had come on the trip as a group of black women. And I remember looking at them with so much like joy, thinking, I want to go on your trip too, you know, and wonder what it was like for them. Because they definitely had an affinity-based trip, which is powerful. But we have to be honest about our history and our structures and why the world looks the way it does and why some people have more money to lay it on the line and not think it's a mystery and understand that economic divide and inequality is structural and it's by design. It's not by chance that we have these systems in place.
Where do you see us right now? I mean, when you think about the reckoning that we're having, there's so many more conversations around history and the truth, conversations around violence, the murders of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, the list is so long. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about where we are right now? I don't even really want to bring up this whole critical race theory. I don't even know what to say about it. I mean, people are actually going to these school board meetings and screaming about this. And now it's taking up so much space in the media.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We are right where we were at the end of the Civil War with this critical race theory conversation. So the reason why there are numerous federal monuments around the country. The reason why slavery is not talked about extensively in schools, why we don't study history at the level of black history, which is American history, at the same level as the rest of American history. The Daughters of the Confederate renamed this Civil War. I'm sorry, they restructured the way we think about the Civil War. They started what was called the Lost Cause. I'm not making this up. This is history. And the Lost Cause was going to talk about the victory and the beauty of the South, not the struggle and ownership of people and not the enslavement of people, but this wonderful place that we had. So they stripped down what happened to education. They still are successful a number of years ago, like 8, 9, 10 years ago in Texas. They won a case to keep like an additional paragraph being added about slavery in the textbooks. And there was a cause that was in place to push forward white supremacy. Like, let's label it, identify it, and accept it. what we're seeing right now with this pushback on critical race theory, which folks don't understand, call Kimberly Crenshaw and get the real discussion of what critical race theory is and what it was meant when it started in law schools. Get that first before we slam it and make it a law. It's like it's illegal for some states now to teach critical race theory without them even understanding what critical race theory is. What has happened is the same thing that happened after the Civil War. Folks saw African-Americans potentially moving forward, getting advanced. The period was called Reconstruction, and they tore it down. We're seeing right now a year of the world saying, hey, we just witnessed an officer execute a black man on camera, another one. And we just saw an officer actually get judged, in my mind, fairly, and get indicted and get charged with that murder. Things have shifted. There's a group rising up saying, slow down. Black people, you're taking power away from white people. Let's fight this. Let's fight against critical race theory. I mean, I try and make my talk real plain speak, you know, which I think is what we avoid. And I say this all the time. I quote Toni Morrison. She said that one of the biggest offenses of racism is distraction. So this push for critical race theory, ending, all that stuff, is distraction from us continuing to fight forward to take apart racism, to fight for equity and justice. People are fearful that it's a zero-sum game. I think people sit in the space of like, if I allow them to teach critical race theory, I will feel bad. Not if I allow them to teach critical race theory, there might be equality and justice for all, and we might take apart racism further. People get stuck in like, I'll feel bad, I'll lose, this is not right. As opposed to, I might feel bad for a few minutes, but the benefit for our larger society is much better. We all suffer from racism. Racism hurts all of us. And the more we sit fighting amongst ourselves or pointing out who is not, we miss the opportunity to really take it down. I'll say my last little piece on that. People spend more time concerned about being called a racist than they do about racism. That's work that I uncovered with my company, Point Made Learning, with another one of our films called I'm Not Racist, Am I? Where we look at this question of what can we do to talk about racism? Let's talk about it, decide we're going to do, move forward and take it apart.
Today we are speaking with Andre Robert Lee, a filmmaker, activist, and teacher. He has made a number of really incredible films. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. He's executive director of The Road to Justice. It follows two groups on recent civil rights tours of southern states for The Nation magazine. Andre leads those tours. We meet a group of mostly black middle school students from Chicago and a group of mostly white older people who lived through the civil rights era. A few questions from listeners, Andre. Are there any scholarships or discounts for this tour?
Yeah, you know, that is something we talked about. Each group of travelers have said that they would love to instill that. That's not in place right now with The Nation magazine, but it is something that is talked about, and I believe it can happen. I mentioned my friend Miss Annie Pearl in Selma, Alabama. Our last visit with her car had gotten stuck on a railroad tracks and hit and destroyed. And the travelers worked together, collected money, and bought her a new car because her work is so important. I know that we can do it and there's a commitment to it because we need it. We need to find ways to bring other people into the trips.
And people can host screenings. Are there other ways to see the film?
Yeah, right now, and that's a model that I built out of Prep School Negro with Point Made Learning, where we believe in getting people into a space to have the conversation. So right now, we're waiting to hear from some film festivals. We're so hopeful that's a chance. We're praying and hoping that PBS or someone else comes in as a partner. Mm. But right now, what we're doing is we're having these small little private screenings where we go to institutions and we just host and set up. And it's so much easier than you imagine. I did one yesterday with UPenn Medical Department, Medical Schools, and they have a program called Bridging the Gap, and they partnered with, and I love this program. They work with a group called Bridging the Gap. And what they do is they work with people who are going to various careers that are supporting people, and they spend time having to think about other ways of looking at the world. So it's not just classes on nursing and social work, medical doctors. That's important. Listen, you know what? Let's make you a better person overall. So have this whole program that's set up that's in line with the medical program to help them learn about being better people. And one thing they did is they brought me in to Scream Month. We did it online. We had nearly 200 people. We watched and they had a conversation. So the ways to see the film right now is hopefully at a film festival near you. Or to book a screening. We're keeping it very tight because we're hopeful that we'll get distribution someday.
That would be amazing if it were on PBS because it would be such a great film to show in schools.
Yeah, from your lips to God's ears. I think that's where that phrase applies.
Let's try to make that happen. Let's play another clip from The Road to Justice. This one is absolutely amazing. I had to watch this one a couple times. This is Elizabeth Eckford, one of the Little Rock Nine, a group of African-American students who were the first black students ever to attend classes at the previously all-white Little Rock Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. This was in 1957. What's so amazing about Elizabeth Eckford, she is the little girl in that photo that we have seen so many times who was screamed at by mostly looked like white girls to me as she attempted to go to school at the Little Rock Central High School. And here is a clip from The Road to Justice.
I grew up here. I was born under Jim Crow law before civil rights. I was a sharecropper. Sharecropping is not slavery, but it's slavery. I was born right out here in the field to the left.
I don't expect that my name will mean anything to you, but there is an image that is referential of what was happening when I first attempted to go to school here. I'm going to start off by asking if you have any questions. If you don't ask questions, make me think I'm wasting my time. Okay, yes?
How did you endure the hatred?
What people saw that day was not the worst that we had to endure. The worst was inside the school. From the beginning until the end of the school year, we were pummeled every day. The people who were not hitting me or slamming me against wall lockers or trying to lock me downstairs, they were among the silent witnesses.
I was a kid while this was happening, and I had no idea of what went on, especially over the course of the year, because the news kind of faded out. So it's
among the nine of us, nobody talked about what it was like inside school for 30 years. And the reason is that when I first started trying to talk about this, I would break down and cry. You can never have true reconciliation until we honestly acknowledge our painful but share it past. You can't skip these difficult conversations and get to reconciliation. It's impossible.
That is Elizabeth Eckford, one of the Little Rock Nine, a group of African-American students who were the first black students to ever attend classes at Little Rock Central High in 1957. And that is a clip from The Road to Justice. Andre, that was so amazing to see that, to learn that Elizabeth and the others did not talk about this for 30 years.
Yeah. It is absolutely incredible. And she's wonderful. You know, I remember my first visit with her, she pulled me aside and said, "I need you to help me." She said, "If you see white people surrounding me, come to my rescue because it's too much." She still has post-traumatic syndrome. When she's surrounded by white people, it hurts her. It scares her. And think about that picture. You know, the picture you mentioned, which is a pretty iconic photo where she's holding her books. She has a beautiful white dress. She told me when she got home, her dress was soaking wet. And it was a completely dry day. It was covered in spit by the people. Imagine that. Imagine. So what happened with that day, you know, she didn't have a phone at home. This is 1950s. They didn't have a phone in the home. And the nine kids had talked, the eight kids, I should say, eight families had talked the night before to all go together. And she didn't get that call. So she went there by herself, which is why she had such a terrible experience. Elizabeth Eckford is absolutely incredible. And she shares that story. And she's given me the curriculum for the movie. Because she says we have to think about what we are silently witnessing. And I think that is such a powerful statement. What do you witness that you don't say something about? That's how you perpetuate the problems in our society. And that line about reconciliation, she says so much in a few minutes. And to be in a room with her, you just feel the power. She's a really simple, easy, older Black woman who's just sweet and kind with a great wit. You heard her, you know, and she's phenomenal. And it's a moment for everyone when you spend time with her, because she's just a force. She's incredible.
Well, I really encourage everyone to, if you can, go online to search for images of Elizabeth Eckford, because that one iconic photo has gotten so much attention, where this woman, white women are behind her looking so angry and one is yelling at her. But there are others that I've never seen before, where she's walking by herself and then a line of like 10 white women and then white men behind them are right behind her. Another one of her sitting on a bench surrounded by white people. Yeah. I mean, it's so chilling. And then to hear you say, she told you, if you know, please come over if a bunch of white people are around me, because she's got PTSD from all of this.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Really amazing.
It's amazing. And she was a 15-year-old girl that day. She was 15, trying to start ninth grade. Imagine, think of yourself at 15. Could you have survived that?
Oh, even now, I can't even imagine surviving something like that. What about the young Black kids who meet people like her, like Elizabeth Eckford, and they're her age or even younger? What strikes you about their reaction?
Yeah, you know, with this film, I decided to be exec producer and have two younger people direct it. Kylia Warren is Black and Brendan Hall is white. And the two of them were our two directors in the film. And I wanted that because I wanted a young voice. And also, sometimes people ask, what can I do when it comes to equity and justice? Sometimes you got to get out of the way. And that's what I did in this project. And the young people from Chicago, they're from a private school in Chicago, primarily Black school. That's a private school in Chicago, which for me, when I heard that, I was like, ooh, that's interesting, you know? Mm-hmm. And then they were so curious, you know, they're sixth, seventh, and eighth graders. It was hard to get their attention at first. I like to jokingly say that on my two trips is the exact same complaints. I'm hungry. I'm tired. It's too cold. It's too hot in here. The old people and the kids, they both say it. So the kids were so present and they were so curious and they leaned into it. You know, they had some great teachers who were there guiding them. They had been studying this curriculum beforehand. And to see them, you know, their eyes just opened up. When we got to Birmingham and they learned that the Children's March was led by kids their age, you know, that was a life-changing moment, I think, for all of them. Wow. They really were just like, whoa, we could do this? You know, I was like, yes, you can, and you should, and we need you to march and protest and demand change.
Wow. Final thoughts, Andre, about, you know, where we are right now, and just there's so much work that needs to be done. I mean, given that you're hopeful, and I love that, there's a lot of truth-telling that is happening right now. I mean, the Native boarding schools, the Indian boarding schools, that's coming out, finally. I mean, it's taking so long, but I feel like the information is coming out, and people actually do want it. It's just that the ones that say the most horrific things tend to get the most attention, but people do want this information.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, I'm talking to you down for, I'm actually in New York City. I came here for the day. I'm sitting in the studio of two artists I'm working on. And our next film is about using art as a tool to talk to and experience with incarcerated people. Mm. And what these two artists are there, Stephen and William Ladd,
the Ladd brothers that go by. And I'm looking around the room and thinking, like, this is the hope that we're talking about. You know, these are two guys who are from Missouri, and they go into prisons and use art and talk to incarcerated people to try and give them love, energy, support, and to find a way to get their voices heard. So my final thoughts, and I'm clearly sneaking in my next project, I had to do that. But I say that because what I try and do is I try and attach myself to projects, ideas that are about change, and finding people that are committed to change. Somebody can be the president of the country. Someone can make a movie and tour the country. Someone can make art and sit down with someone and have them tell the individual story and try and communicate it. Someone can be in a classroom and say, hey, think about what you're saying and rephrase that question, rephrase that statement. I believe that we all have to find our way to show up and push for the change that we believe in. Mm-hmm. Because I just think that's how we do it. I've never worked on a policy level. That's not my ministry, as my sister would say. But what I do is I work at it on the individual and human level. I try and impact people with my art to help them find love in their heart, to help them step forward and believe in change, and to deal with what may be hard and what may hurt when it comes to dealing with some of these issues. We have to look at ourselves, look at how we show up in the world, and push for better. You know, my whole career is committed to making the world a better place. That's what I want. It's hard. We're hearing lots of voices. There's lots of pushback. I'm brokenhearted about this on the voting rights bill. I've had talks with my libertarian friends and big government, blah, blah, blah. But still, I'm like, you do realize they're saying little old women in the South will no longer be able to go to the poll because it'll close early and we can't give them water. And they need to have 5 forms of identification. I'm exaggerating a bit. But when I come to that, I think we got to keep pushing and fighting, because some folks are coming out of a place of fear and with these movements.
Well, Andre, your work is amazing, and I'm so glad we got to spend the hour with you. Huge respect for your work. We'd love to have you in studio if you're ever in the Bay Area, once we're able to see each other in person again. So thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I have a ton of friends in the Bay Area that would love to have you come out to stay on their couches and visit. So I would love to. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the invitation.
Thank you so much. That's Andre Robert Lee, a filmmaker, activist, and teacher. Find more information about his work, yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.